Today's episode of Expanded Perspectives is sponsored by Gaia.com. If y'all are like us, you've exhausted everywhere else you find your documentaries on the strange and unusual and the fun. And if you like grand conspiracies and more breakaway societies, paranormal, ancient civilizations like we all do, and UFOs, well, we found the place right at your fingertips, folks. You can stream videos from anywhere, from your living room or on the go, with access to over 7,000 titles, all on Gaia.com, G-A-I-A. Now, you can get this for a monthly plan of $9.95 a month. Your first month will only be 99 cents. Now, there is a three-month plan and an annual plan. So, if you're into the things that we're into, and judging by what you're listening to, you are, start enjoying Gaia.com. Expand your perspective even more. GAIA.com. There, friends and family, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right, it's me, it's Cam Hale, and as always, across the table from me, the sparkle in my eye, mi amigo, the filio, Kyle Filson. Philly, you've got to tell me, how did it go? I know it's been baseball madness. You've been busy the last two or three days. We ain't had a whole lot of time to chat and do a whole lot. You've been blowing and going, man.
It was good. Jacob just got put on a new travel team. And so we've been practicing with them in addition to the regular team. And so it feels like that's all we're doing. But it is that time of year. It's spring. The weather's been nice. And so it's been really busy. It's been so busy that it feels like the days and weeks have been going by at light speed. It's like, oh, my God, March is almost over already. I still have things I got to get together for the CPA, you know, for the tax man and everything. It's just going by super fast. But, no, it's been good. And the season is just about to ramp up. So all this practice and all this drilling and training and stuff we've been doing, it's all in preparation for the upcoming season, which starts this week. So you ready for it? Like literally like 4 days away from our first game. Yeah, I'm ready for it.
It's fun. They actually get to go and do what all the work they've put in. It's when it gets fun.
I really enjoy baseball. So
yeah, I'm a big fan. And if you're listening to this, let's see, here in the States, we're 14 days away from opening day of the majors. So you know what? Man, I'm ready. I'm ready to go see a little baseball. I'm ready. I'm not ready for the heat. It's getting hotter over here. We're not having fun with that.
I was mowing the yard and weed eating all day. That's pretty much what I did for like the first 4 or 5 hours today.
Try to get it was cool.
Yard work. It's been something I've been putting off for weeks.
Yeah.
Feels like. But every time I must probably decapitate 13 to 27 dinosaurs probably every time I'm out. I mean, they're just always left in the tall grass. Yeah. And they there's another one.
Like Jurassic Park. All of them got just drunk and passed out, and you're running over them.
Oh, dude. Luke has the biggest dinosaur collection I've ever seen. Like, without exaggeration, he probably has, like, I don't know, 800 dinosaurs.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Little plastic ones up to big ones. They're everywhere.
And he doesn't care. Like, literally, you can go to a Dollar General and buy, like, a 35-cent dinosaur. He's cool with it. He's like, oh, man, yeah.
I need that one.
I like that. You're like, it's garbage.
I need that one, though.
Yep.
He's got to do something with it. He has to. It's going to be his obsession.
You think he'll be a paleontologist or something?
Yeah, yeah. He's going to be obsessed with it.
It's possible.
He is now. He can pronounce things that I'm like, what is that? And he tells me, I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. He could make it up. I would never know.
That's me. You know so many names.
Make it up.
If he made it up, I wouldn't know any difference.
I have no idea. Well, we're going to jump into the news. We're going to get rocking and rolling. This comes from sciencealert.com. This is horrible news. This is horrible news. Cue the Terminator music, cue the end of the world music. This doesn't get any worse than this. Scientists want to build a super fast, self-replicating computer that grows as it computes.
Oh, great. So like a T-1000,
yeah,
right?
Here you go. Exactly. Now, they're scientists, and they say it's possible to build a new type of self-replicating computer that replaces silicon chips with processors made from DNA molecules. And it would be faster than any other form of computer ever proposed, even quantum computers. Called a non-deterministic universal Turing machine, it's predicted that the technology could execute all possible algorithms at once by taking advantage of DNA's ability to replicate almost perfect copies of itself over billions of years. It says that the basic idea of this current electronic computers are based on a finite number of silicon chips, and we're fast approaching the limit of how many we can actually fit into these machines. To address this limitation, researchers are currently working on making quantum computers a reality, which is a super powerful device that replaces the bits of electronic computers with quantum entangled particles called qubits. But unlike regular bits, that can only take on the form of one or zero in a binary code, qubits can take on the form of zero, one, or a superposition of the two simultaneously, which allows them to perform many different calculations at once. So they talk about this. They're getting in. Now, look, this thing, we could go on. And to be honest, like we said, if I say those words and I don't mess them up, I sound like I know what I'm talking about.
Right? Yeah.
But I don't. Because I've read this about four times, and basically all I can figure out is that they're going to use DNA as a medium for information processing and storage. That's what they want to do, because it can replicate so much faster. And they're actually, here's a quote from Ross King, one of the team members, says, "Our computer's ability to grow as it computes makes it faster than any other form of computer and enables the solution of many computational problems previously considered impossible." Goes on to say that quantum computers are an exciting other form of computer, and they can also follow both paths in a maze, but only if the maze has certain symmetries which greatly limit their use. So basically what this thing is going to be able to do is it's just unhinging. You're just taking it off the reins. Ross says this, as DNA molecules are very small, a desktop computer could potentially utilize more processors than all the electronic computers in the world combined, and therefore outperform the world's current fastest supercomputer while consuming a tiny fraction of energy. So that's right, you heard it. They'll be able to use this DNA computer that would be the size of your desktop right now, your desktop computer, and it would be actually faster than all other computers on the planet at this time combined.
Man, that is scary, right?
This isn't a good thing. I mean, and look, it goes on, and they start, like I said, they start rambling about stuff that I'm going to have to talk to dudes that are really into computers about all this. But I don't like this idea. I'm not a fan because
isn't
I'm not a
good
fan
enough?
Of...
Like, what's wrong with the iPhone 7? Do we have to keep making the next one? The
yeah,
next
can we
one
stop
like,
now? What's wrong? Make this one better, but we don't need to build another one.
It's pretty good. The world's pretty good right now. It's pretty the way it exists right now.
You're exactly right. Look, folks, like I said, I urge you to go out and look this whole thing up. Start looking at these DNA, computers or whatever that's coming, because it does feel like what we talked about on the Elite Show and what we've talked about now on this, that the ability for them to build Terminators with the DNA, because you're talking about something that's going to grow and compute and be lightning fast, faster than we can think, and be unstoppable.
Man, that's terrifying.
Yeah, it's not going to be good.
Do you think that me and you, will live to see the day where AI is running things?
I hope not, but yes. Well, we already have. I mean, let's be honest, a self-driving car, Tesla's got it. That's what it is.
Yeah, did you see that where they were canceling their cheapest model of Tesla car, which is kind of a bummer for me because I was hoping to get one day.
Yeah, I think it's going to be something that what we're afraid of now is going to be the norm in 50 years.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, it's the same as these phones, and I'm holding my phone in my hand. It's the exact same thing as this device here.
Yeah.
You know, 50 years ago, nobody even thought this was possible.
No.
You know, and like we talk about now, I heard somebody discussing somewhere about the fact that they believe that they're saying, and this is kind of getting off topic, but they say that drug use amongst teenagers are down across the board on drugs and alcohol in the U.S. And they say what the reason they believe from is the dopamine dumps that kids get when they open their phone and look at Instagram or Snapchat or all that same little dopamine dump you get from likes and people retweeting and you know, this interaction of social media is the same feelings that you and I would get when we'd go out and get hammered. So it's the same
thing. That's crazy.
Right? So they're saying that it's, but you're trading one for the other is basically what you're doing. So yeah, I'm not a fan of this whole thing. Like I said, I'm gonna be the old man in the mountains up in the woods that don't want to be messed with.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we talk on this show from time to time about spontaneous human combustion. And I noticed an article that I read recently over there on Popular Science, and it's a story actually about how some corpses may mysteriously heat up after death. It says that one morning in a hospital in the Czech Republic, a 69-year-old man died of heart disease. An hour later, as nurses were preparing to move his body down to the lab for the autopsy, they noticed his skin was unusually warm. After calling the doctor back to make sure the man was really dead, which it turned out that he was, they took his temperature. At 1.5 hours, Cam, after his death, the body was at 104 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 5 degrees hotter than it was before he died, even though the hospital room was kept at about, they say, 68 degrees. Now, fearing the body might spontaneously combust, the doctor and the nurses took pains to cool it down with ice packs and eventually got it as chilly as one would expect of a corpse. Now, this interesting case study is published in, I know you get the subscription to this, the American Journal of Forensic Medicine and Pathology.
I just got one.
And in fact, has nothing to do with spontaneous combustion, they say. They say post-mortem hypothermia is a well-documented phenomenon, but it's not well understood. And in fact, it's not necessarily known by a lot of people. They say that in a living body, cells generate heat as they break down food, usually keeping the body temperature at around a comfortable 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. After death, though, with no food and no oxygen to digest it with, cells generally stop producing heat, and the body cools down at a fairly predictable rate over several hours. Now, the investigators commonly use body temperature to estimate how long it's been since the person died, which can be essential in solving a murder, for example. They say, unfortunately, the relationship between body temperature and time may not always be so straightforward. They say in 1839, physician John Davy documented some unusually high temperatures in the bodies of British soldiers who died in Malta. Some corpses got as hot as 113 degrees Fahrenheit, and although Davy speculated the warm climate might have played a role, the post-mortem heating has been documented by numerous other physicians and forensic scientists over time. They said that the phenomenon has been difficult to study because the cases are fairly rare and unpredictable, and not everyone dies in hospital beds with their temperature carefully monitored. They say many factors may make the body more susceptible to post-mortem heating, and they're wide-ranging, and they can include intoxication, brain trauma, asphyxiation, cancer, drug use, infection, heart attack, or even excited delirium. As for what's causing the heating, most papers just hand wave and say metabolic processes, and there's even this latest paper suggests that continuing tissue and bacterial metabolism and insufficient thermal loss is the reason. So basically, they're not sure what's causing certain bodies to heat up, and it makes me wonder about these stories of spontaneous human combustion. Could that be what's happening? And somebody's dying, and then later the body's heating up? Or is it kind of like your body's like a compost pile? You know, if you pile a bunch of leaves and stuff together, over time that pile will actually heat up.
Yes, that's what I believe. Is I believe it has to do with a lot. It has to do a lot with diet, I think. And then, of course, like we talked about, when things start breaking down, much like a compost, is I think that's what would cause a lot of this.
Yeah, so anyways, it's a very interesting article. If you hear me wheezing a little bit, I just got done mowing, like I said, and my allergies get acting up. I can hear myself doing it as I'm reading, so I apologize, folks.
As he's dying. I'm not going to perform mouth-to-mouth on you again. Anyway, so we're going back to I Got You Something Here. And this, the reason I jumped on this is because it's not a black triangle, folks. I don't have a chevron. This is a disc. This comes from Open Minds. Roger Marsh posted this up. Disc UFO caught on camera moving out of bay. A Canadian witness at Port Grivel reported discovering a disc-shaped object moving out of a local bay and shooting into the sky after watching video previously shot in the area. Now, this is from case number 82086 of the MUFON.
Got it.
Right? Now, it says the witness was at the Bay of Fundy in Nova Scotia, staying at a friend's beach cottage on August 6th of 2016 when the incident occurred. This is what they had to say. I was watching a fairly intense lightning storm roll into the mouth of the bay off the Atlantic. We were waiting for our barbecue to finish, and I began to film the storm, hoping to get some good footage of the lightning as I waited. The storm was still a good 20 minutes away, but the lightning was going straight down into the water almost every time, and I continued to film for about 2 minutes. Now, the witness captured nothing out of the ordinary except for one very close double flash of lightning and an immediate loud bang. Witness says that I put my camera away, ate supper as a storm passed overhead, and thought nothing more of it until 2 or 3 days later when I was going through the video. I watched it normally and saw nothing. Got to the end and hit pause during one of the lightning strikes. Took a screenshot for Facebook and continued to scroll backwards very slowly, going from lightning strike to lightning strike, taking screenshots. As I got to the very seconds, or the first seconds, it says, of the video, during the double lightning bolt, I could see a disc-like object the size of a semi-trailer flying out of the bay at an angle at an unimaginable speed across the sky through the double flash and up into the clouds with a bang and a whirly wind tunnel echo sound. It says the object was captured all within a single second on video. This is but. With determination and brain surgeon fingers, I was able to get screenshots of it within that second. I have some unbelievable video and even more unbelievable pictures. I've spent almost 8 months seeking help and getting nowhere. I pray you people take me serious and show interest because this is real. And if you go and you look at these pictures, my only question is, what could that be? Because if right. you look at that, you could say it's a blur, right? It's something right. blurring by. But if you're filming and you catch that lightning strike and then your screenshot, you know, you're just frame by frame of that lightning strike.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you see right before the lightning strike hit the blur in the bottom left of the screen? Then the lightning strike is it's here in the middle. Then the next one, it's blurred up in the top right, you know, as it clicks by frame by frame. I'm not sure the frame rate of the video that he was taking. You know, if it's 24 frames per second, maybe it was already through. Maybe it was only caught in one frame. But when you look at that, it does resemble a disc that is started because there's a couple of pictures. Low to the water, coming like it had left the water, and then one higher up near the clouds, and then it's gone.
Yeah, I'm looking at it, but I don't know enough about photography. Is it really a rod, or is it something that's moving and it makes it look like a rod? Like maybe that's just a bird or something, but it looks elongated because of the speed of the thing?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying is I don't know the frames per second rate, the frame rate that the camera was shooting at.
Yeah,
what the was video it, to know. 60 frames per second is great for slow-mo. The human eye sees at 24. So that's the reason we see a blur if you move your hands.
Remember
side
the guy years ago, Jose Escamilla, was going around talking about these rods, yes. and these things that live in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And then it turned out that they were just
bugs
and stuff moving around in photos.
That could easily be what that is, but the problem still with
it could also very easily be a UFO or USO. Yes.
Yeah, well, that's because as it goes up into the clouds, it looks to disappear going up into the clouds. Yeah,
no, I see it. You know? And it does look like a UFO.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is one of those ones that I like because it's a disc, first off.
Right.
I like the whole idea of the USO. I don't know. This is one of those ones you're like, man, this looks almost too good to be true. Yeah, it's got a blur to the disc, but the lightning is crisp. So you know you're catching that.
Yeah.
So that tells you the speed at which that frame is stuck at.
The problem with modern day software is, you know, programs like Photoshop, Lightroom, and stuff.
The manipulation.
Man, you can manipulate a lot of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's always hard to believe with me just from a photograph, but very cool. Check this out. This comes from Two Crows Paranormal over there. David Weatherly posted this article about how a voodoo doll has been causing trouble in Nicaragua.
Oh, awesome.
Santa Thomas, Nicaragua, is a small village in the southern region of the country, and it has been struck with a bizarre series of incidents being attributed to black magic. Citizens of the village appear to be suffering from greasy sickness, or the crazy sickness in English. The syndrome has been known to affect communities in Central America. Symptoms of the condition include dizzy spells, nausea, paranoia, outbursts of anger, and periods of rapid frenzy that include wild movements and out-of-control behaviors. Sounds like a lot of our listeners on St. Patrick's Day. Those suffering the condition can become very violent during these episodes. Victims have also had visions of demons and spirits while in their trance-like state and are believed to be possessed during these fits. Over 30 villagers have now been affected by the symptoms. Even the contagious aspect of the condition is odd. When a person is infected, it's said, they announce the name of the next person who will come down with the disease. One woman in the village attempted to help her friends by creating an herbal remedy for the condition. Now, Maricela, who makes herbal potions, mixed up a remedy to pour over the affected victims, hoping it would drive away the evil spirits. She determined that the source of the trouble was black magic, and that someone intentionally worked a spell to affect the entire village. Following up on her theory, Maricela believes she found the source of the dark spell. It was, get ready, a voodoo doll.
Oh, hey now!
The doll was found hidden in the village. It wears a black ribbon and has a cross drawn across its face. Maricela and the other villagers believe that the doll was used to place a curse on them and send evil spirits into their midst. The people decided to burn the doll, believing that such an act would break the dark magic placed on them. Mass possession, mass hysteria, or something else at work. It says no further updates have been reported on the current conditions in the village. Only time will tell if the burning ceremony has somehow cleansed the community and its people. So it's shocking to me that even, you know, parts of Haiti, parts of Nicaragua, parts of Central America like that, there's this belief in this black magic. And, you know, what would cause all these people to act crazy if it wasn't this cursed doll? You know what I mean? Like, how could it be contagious? If you were acting crazy, how would all of a sudden your neighbors start acting crazy?
I hate the idea of these cursed dolls.
Over 30 people.
That I just don't like them.
I don't like that. I don't know what it is, but like when you start hearing voodoo, I start being like, nope, I don't want to talk about it.
I'm out.
I remember being a child and going into some voodoo shops there in the French Quarter in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being creeped out like they had all these spells. I'm sure it's...
True, you first met your wife, what?
No.
Oh.
I'm sure if I went there now, it probably wouldn't look... It wouldn't seem so real to me. But as a kid, I was like, dude, I thought I was in like a real witch's... shop. And like, yeah, if I bought these spells, this stuff would work.
It's 100% legit. But you know why? Because as a kid, when you went into the mechanic shop, he fixed your car. When you went into the bait shop, you bought stuff to catch fish. When you go to the voodoo shop,
yeah,
you're buying voodoo, baby. That's what it's there
but
for.
But there are people that really believe in it. And now as an adult, I'm like, look, I don't know if I believe it 100%, but I also don't want to mess around with it. So what is it that gives me those reservations about, well, not messing around
with
it?
Well, you're intelligent, just like that. Like, you don't know if that dog's going to bite you, but you ain't going to give him a chance because you're not getting in his backyard.
I'm going to double down and just keep walking.
Just be like, hey, look, you do you. I'm going to go on down here and get another cold beer.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Well, folks, let's take a break. And after the break, I'm going to be talking about some lost cosmonauts. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. On Wednesday, April 12, 1961, the Soviet Union announced that cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin had become the first man to journey into outer space. Overnight, the 27-year-old became a national hero and the most famous man in the world. His achievement, recognized in the front page headlines from Washington to Beijing. For the Soviets, this was a spectacular validation of the communist system. They had beaten the capitalist Americans to yet another crucial space milestone and demonstrated that their technological supremacy to the entire world. Gagarin was the perfect face for the USSR. A committed communist, he was also young and photogenic. For Russian leader Khrushchev, this major propaganda coup could hardly have gone any better. But not everyone was convinced. Right from the first announcement, there were question marks about the story the Soviet press agencies were putting out. Several days previously, Western correspondents in Moscow had been tipped off that a successful flight had already taken place. Soviet state TV cameras had even moved in to film them reporting the news. But the news never came. Not until Gagarin's flight was announced on the 12th. The notoriously secretive Soviets seemed to be spinning the story. Then, the Daily Worker, a British communist newspaper with connections in the Kremlin, reported on the 12th that the launch had actually occurred the previous Friday. The newspaper claimed, according to its sources, that the flight was a success, but the return to Earth had gone wrong and the cosmonaut had landed far off course and was badly injured. Could this be the reason for the cover-up? Unlike the rivals at NASA, the Soviet space program was run on a military basis and operated under intense secrecy. It also had a history of covering up mistakes. It seemed unlikely the Soviet leadership would want to invite the eyes of the world on its achievement if it had gone partially wrong. If this earlier flight had succeeded in putting a man into orbit, then who was he? Numerous press reports at the time intimated. It was a famous test pilot called Vladimir Ilyushin. Unlike the rookie Gagarin, Ilyushin was the USSR's most experienced and decorated test pilot. His father was also a famous aircraft designer with close ties to the Kremlin. Ilyushin, rather than Gagarin, was the obvious choice for such a prestigious mission. But what if the mission was not entirely successful? In a climate of propaganda and secrecy, could the Soviet leadership really handle a perceived embarrassment if it was to be revealed to the world? I doubt it. It is therefore not far-fetched to suggest that Ilyushin's conjectured and ill-fated flight was therefore airbrushed out of the official Soviet space history. But could the truth be far darker than mere Cold War paranoia? Unbeknownst to the Soviets, two young Italian brothers, known as the Giudica and Cordiglia brothers, sons of one of Europe's foremost pathologists, they had secretly set up a listening post which probed the cosmos and successfully tracked all of the early American and Soviet unmanned satellites. The pair, keen amateur radio buffs, were excited about the prospect of trying to capture and record transmissions from these early missions. Using borrowed and scavenged equipment, they set up a listening station in an old World War II bunker on the outskirts of Turin that they dubbed Torre Bert. Over the coming years, the station would record thousands of hours of flight telemetry and voice communications from Sputnik, Vostok, Explorer, and numerous other Soviet and American programs. In 1960, the brothers made headlines in Italy and around the world with their claim that they had heard communications from a secret, clandestine Russian space launch. The geographical location of their station proved particularly suitable for the reception of Soviet space vehicles, which regularly overflew the northern Italy area during their approach to the Soviet tracking centers in the Caucasus. Using an array of advanced equipment, the two young Italians soon learned which radio frequencies to monitor and how to predict the overfly times of the various space probes. One day, while eavesdropping, weeks before Yuri Gagarin's epic spaceflight, instead of the usual beeping tones which they had become accustomed to, they heard something different. They were startled by a sound which signaled a new chapter in the history of mankind. There, in the listening center of these two young brothers, heard clearly and unequivocally the beat of a failing heart and the last gasping breaths of a dying cosmonaut. If genuine, the first man in space never made it back to Earth. As for Yuri Gagarin, he never flew into space again. After his initial fame faded, his life began to spiral out of control. He started to drink, and his behavior at official functions was often an embarrassment to the party. Gagarin died in a mysterious jet crash in 1968, itself subject to many conspiracy theories. Was his sad downfall a consequence of living with a terrible lie? Had a lost cosmonaut actually beaten him to the crown of the first man in space? Whilst the Soviet Union trumpeted its achievements in space around the world, it was studious in concealing its mistakes. From huge disasters to minor indiscretions, the leadership would airbrush anything regarded as embarrassing, figuratively and often literally, out of the historical record. In October 1960, at least 150 people were incinerated on a launch pad after an explosion of an R-16 ballistic missile. The disaster, later named the Nedelin catastrophe, after the chief marshal of the artillery, who was killed in the accident, was quickly shrouded in a veil of official secrecy. It wasn't until 39 years later, in 1989, as communism began to fall, that the truth was finally acknowledged by the Soviet government. The death of a young fighter pilot, Valentin Bondarenko, in a fire during cosmonaut training in 1961, was also concealed by the USSR until 1986. At the other end of the scale, cosmonaut Grigory Grigorievich Nelyubov was expelled from the program for brawling, and his image was subsequently airbrushed out of the official photographs. There were also numerous reports of pre-Gagarin cosmonauts perishing in attempted manned spaceflights. In 1959, renowned German rocket scientist Hermann Oberth, then working for the U.S., quoted American intelligence reports detailing a number of failed manned space launches. According to these reports, at least one cosmonaut died in 1957 or 1958, and there were possibly others in 1959. This coincided with intelligence coming out of Czechoslovakia, which told a similar story. According to the Czech leak, four cosmonauts perished in doomed launches: Alexei Ledvatsky, Andriy Mikhatkov, Sergei Shaborin, and Maria Gromova. That's right, a woman. The possibility that these unfortunate men and women may still be floating in the deep cold of space, their capsules having become their tombs, is deeply disturbing. The two Italian brothers claimed to have overheard several other doomed spaceflights as well. In May 1960, they first picked up communications from what appeared to be an unpublicized manned Soviet flight. If so, presumably it had failed to return its occupants to Earth alive. Interesting, the corroboration for this came from a writer named Robert A. Heinlein, who heard of such a manned attempt from Russian soldiers while traveling in Vilnius in May 1960. Later that year, at Tore Bert, they tracked a faint SOS signal from a craft that seemed to be departing Earth's orbit. Again, if this recording was genuine, we would have to assume the men had not survived. The station in Turin continued to pick up broadcasts of apparently doomed Soviet missions for the next few years, including the desperate last words of a female cosmonaut before she burnt up on reentry. In 2001, a senior engineer on the Soviet space program came forward to confirm what the brothers had seemingly caught on tape. Mikhail Rudenko told Pravda that spacecraft with pilots named Ledovishky, Shaborin, and Mitkov were launched from the Kapustin Yar cosmodrome in 1957, 1958, and 1959. All three pilots died during the flights, and their names were never officially published. But not everything the listening station picked up was so horrific. One transmission seemed to suggest that someone else had made it into space and back just before Gagarin's official flight. Vladimir Sergeyevich Ilyushin was Russia's greatest test pilot and holder of multiple speed and altitude records. For those skeptical of Yuri Gagarin's claim to be the first man to travel into space, Ilyushin is the most likely alternative, or at least the most likely alternative that made it back to Earth alive. Ilyushin was named as the true first man in space by foreign journalists in Moscow in the days surrounding Gagarin's purported historical flight. Denis Ogden of the British Daily Worker and French journalist Edward Bobrovsky were amongst the first to identify Ilyushin, and many others soon followed, supposedly on the basis of inside information. Ilyushin had the perfect credentials for the part. He was the son of a legendary aircraft designer, Sergei Ilyushin, and a decorated test pilot in his own right. The family also had impeccable links to the Soviet establishment. His whereabout, around the time of Yuri Gagarin's flight, were shrouded in mystery. In all the fanfare and pomp that surrounded the Gagarin triumph, Ilyushin, one of the country's great heroes, was nowhere to be seen. The official story had it that his absence was because he had a car crash the previous month and was recovering in a hospital. However, this was only the first of many stories. Throughout the aftermath of the Gagarin flight, the Soviet state press agencies, so adept at propaganda, seemed unable to give a consistent account about Ilyushin. In reaction to the foreign press stories that he had been the true first man in space, the Soviets simply denied he was even a cosmonaut. However, in the months before Gagarin's flight, news that Ilyushin was in cosmonaut training had already made it to the Soviet press. There was even a photograph of him in a spacesuit published in the local newspapers. The details of Ilyushin's supposed crash also changed numerous times. Now, it was so serious that it had put him in a coma for almost a year, making it impossible for him to have undergone the cosmonaut training at all. This, too, was undermined by another photograph that appeared showing him looking decidedly conscious and healthy during this time whilst receiving the Hero of the Soviet Union Award. The reason for his prolonged public absence also evolved. The news story had Ilyushin recuperating from his car crash in China, an explanation that raised many eyebrows amongst the seasoned foreign correspondents back in Moscow. You see, the Soviet healthcare system in 1961 was extensive and of high standard. It sounded deeply unlikely that it would send such a prestigious figure to a foreign country just for treatment. Were these unconvincing and shifting accounts simply a cover for the truth the journalists had all been reporting all along? And was the strange story of Ilyushin's absence designed to hide the embarrassing fact that whilst he had made it into space and back, he had landed miles off course and ended up in mainland China? The famous Giudica Cordiglia recordings represent perhaps the most compelling evidence for the theory that other cosmonauts made it into space before Gagarin. The brothers became extremely famous in the Italian press because of their recordings and were subject to many national and international newspaper reports. However, some science writers and space experts who have examined the Italian brothers' evidence have cast doubt on the veracity of their claims. Several aspects of the brothers' recordings did not match known technical and operational details of the Soviet space program, such as the correct communications protocols used by the cosmonauts. Their recording of a craft leaving Earth's orbit was obviously suspect, as the Soviets had no ability to leave orbit in 1961. They did not achieve this capability until 1969. The famous tape with an audible heartbeat, supposedly from a dying cosmonaut, is also unlikely to be genuine, as the Russians did not broadcast such information across audio channels. But perhaps the biggest problem with the brothers' claims is the fact that nobody else was able to reproduce them. While the setup at their secret listening facility was superb for amateurs, it paled in significance compared to a far more sophisticated radio monitoring arrays set up by the Americans, the British, the French, and the Germans. Yet such powerful installations as Jodrell Bank in the UK and America's huge listening station in Turkey had not observed the Russian failures claimed by the two Italians. Bernard Lavelle, director of Jodrell Bank, wrote in 1963, "We have no reason to believe that there have been any unsuccessful manned space attempts by the USSR." So, we could surmise that Lavelle was lying, but for what purpose? By the early 1960s, the Americans were lagging far behind the USSR in the space race, and such an opportunity to exploit the reckless indifference to human life by the Soviets would surely have been taken. The obvious conclusion is that the Giudica-Cordiglia brothers had, at best, made a mistake. Some have suggested that their recordings of a dying cosmonaut were actually one of the many dogs the Soviets sent up into space. A less charitable explanation is the brothers had fabricated the communications and the whole thing was a hoax. Some of the events they claimed to have captured tended to support this. In particular, the recording purporting to be a female cosmonaut's last words as she burns up on re-entry contains poor Russian, broken grammar, and many gibberish phrases. Now, Soviet cosmonauts were renowned for being extremely well-educated, and the idea that they would send someone into space with such a poor command of their own language is highly unlikely. In contrast, the Giudica-Cordiglia brothers' own sister had begun to learn Russian in order to help them with the translations of these tapes. Her level of Russian was much more consistent with the voice on the tapes than a genuine cosmonaut. While there is no doubt the brothers had made genuine recordings, had they fabricated the more sensational tapes in order to keep themselves in the limelight? No one knows. Also, if the Russians were so intensely paranoid about even minor failures becoming public, would they have alerted the world to Gagarin's flight while he was still in orbit? You see, the Soviet space authorities actually announced Gagarin's feat 30 minutes before he landed, and even prepared press releases in case his flight landed off course and they would require international assistance. Clearly, the Kremlin took a pragmatic view of the prospect that a cosmonaut's re-entry into Earth may go wrong, especially with the possibility that they may end up in a foreign country. It therefore makes little sense that they would have gone to such lengths to cover up Ilyushin's supposed off-course landing just 5 days before. Some critics have questioned the original source of the story that Vladimir Ilyushin was the real first man in space. Since 1961, almost every version of the theory has been based on the same April 11th newspaper article in the British communist newspaper The Daily Worker. Journalist Dennis Ogden was responsible for the story and always claimed to have based it on a reliable inside source, but since he refused to name it, it was impossible to verify the information. Many critics think that Ogden's source was really a fig leaf to cover the fact that he had jumped into a rather embarrassing conclusion. Ogden was a neighbor of Ilyushin and had noted his public absence. When a few days before Gagarin's flight, he had heard rumors of a launch. He simply had a journalistic hunch it was Ilyushin on board. The story was little more than a guess on Ogden's part, a guess that was reported around the world and is still cited as evidence of a cover-up some 50 years later. Ogden himself had little confidence in his own scoop, is obvious. The very next day, he wrote a story in the Daily Worker proclaiming Gagarin as the first man in space after all. So, what are we to think about all this? Did the Russians actually lose several cosmonauts in space before Gagarin's historic flight? And are they still floating up there with all the other space debris? Or did the two Italian brothers, along with their sister, create some sort of massive hoax? No one seems to know for sure. There were so many secrets between the two superpowers during those days that I don't think we'll ever know what really happened. Whether they made it back to Earth or not, one thing is for sure. The first cosmonauts and first astronauts were incredibly brave. The very thought of leaving Earth's gravity, unsure if you would ever return, is truly terrifying. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. This story, you know, much like many of the things during the Cold War, there was a lot of secrets between the superpowers, especially, you know, between the U.S. and Russia. And so I'm not sure that we're ever going to really know what happened. But Russia is claiming that, you know, they didn't lose that many cosmonauts. But what about this, you know, alleged radio signal that the two Italian brothers who are listening in, eavesdropping on the Russians talking to their base. I don't know what they call their mission control. Yeah. Like we have Houston for NASA, you know, and they could hear the cosmonauts. They said they could hear them suffocating. They could hear their heartbeats stopping and that those bodies may still be floating around up in space. I mean, if that is true, that's terrifying. And it wouldn't, I mean, it wouldn't, would it surprise you if you found out that that was real? It wouldn't surprise me.
I think it's true. I think it's all, I think it's 100% real.
You know, men, they were trying to get into space. We didn't know. And, you know, just like any other task, you're going to make a couple of mistakes before you figure out how to do it right.
You'll break a few eggs to make an omelet. It always takes that. That's what it takes.
And, you know, I'm reminded of the guys that were some of the first. And the women, of course, the cosmonauts, the Russians, they were using women far earlier than we were. But I mean, I just think about it. I thought about when Felix Baumgartner did the jump out of the balloon, and then a couple of years later when the guy for that used to work at Google did it and beat his records. Anytime you're up in space, how terrifying must it be where they're like, well, no one's ever really done this. We think it'll work.
Yeah.
But we don't know. And you're like, I don't really know if it's going to work. I mean, that's got to be a terrifying feeling to be, I'm the first human to be up here, and then hopefully I'm going to come home. But if I don't, then I guess I just float away into the abyss.
Those are also, though, different types of people. It's hard for us to even relate it to because you got to think about test pilots. What those men paid and women get paid to do is, that's it, you're a test dummy.
Yeah.
You know, and if you can handle it, fine. But there's lots of them, they crash and they get killed. And that's just what, that's what your position is, because you love that sense of adventure, that living on that line.
Living on the edge.
I don't think it bothers them. Yeah, I'm sure there is a lot of regret the last 30 seconds of their life. Is you're like, did I make a mistake? Because I'm not coming back from this. This is over. This is it. This is how I end. So I'm sure everybody has that. But
yeah, and I mean, there's stories of them giving the astronauts and cosmonauts like cyanide tablets. Mm-hmm. And yeah. They said, like, look, if something goes wrong and you can't make it back, you know, here you go. Just swallow these.
Just so you don't starve to death.
Be over in a couple seconds.
Yeah, this won't be no big deal. I mean, really and truly, I understand. I guess in a way, you kind of get romantic. You understand which is better. Is it better to go out setting an example for the world and something like that, or to go out with full of regret laying in your hospital bed at 90? Yeah, I can understand it. But I think they went into space knowing that was a possibility. But for them to cover it up now is preposterous to me, because it doesn't change anything. And yeah, I feel like, yeah, y'all, I want to know the ones, the Americans that not only that we know about died, but how many of them have died maybe we don't know about.
That's what it was, a space race.
Exactly.
So when it was a race, they were heating, they were trying to beat each other. I don't know. Very interesting. If it's in fact true, it's very, very terrifying. You said you had some other news.
Oh, well, I've got something. I got some cool stuff here. First of all, for all of you that love the stories about Atlantis and you want to support who supports us, you go to Gaia, G-A-I-A, Gaia.com. You can watch for free another Beyond Belief with George Norrie. This time he's got Carmen Bolter on about New Atlantis Rising. And Carmen's pieced together many fragmented tales of Atlantis' inheritance by its progeny. So you can go on there and really look at the advanced civilizations, and they've kind of dug some stuff in, but that's not it. You can also go and watch Open Minds with Regina Meredith. You can go watch Missing Links with Greg Braden. You can go watch Truth Hunter with Linda Moulton Howe. I mean, there is Buzzsaw, Wisdom Teachings. It's over and over and over. There's tons of stuff that they're giving you now for free to let you check it out. So if you're into this kind of thing, and if you're listening to us, I know you are, I suggest going over there, dropping by, getting on there, trying out some of the free shows, and getting your learn on. I like to get my learn on.
Right. If you sign up now, the first month is only 99 cents, and after that, it's $9.95 thereafter. So go check it out. There's a 3-month plan as well as an annual plan with over 7,000 titles. I like Gaia. Very cool. My favorite series over there so far is Deep Space. I love that one.
I know you do. You always do. Yeah. You're
talking about the alliance with the Nazis and how they developed this, their Glock, the bell, the secret bell, and they figured out this technology. And, you know, are they able to remember the Vril and all those stories? I love those kind of stories. I don't know what it is, but I just like those kind of stories.
I enjoy Truth Hunter because of Linda, because of getting to meet her and hang out with her and all that stuff.
We're going to be talking to her in like 3 weeks.
But it almost feels like, you know, it's like, it's a good friend of mine up there. You know, and I know it's not, but it does kind of feel that way. And I've got something in closing I'm going to talk to you folks about. This comes from the dailymail.co.uk. Now, we know this is probably a rags, you know, this isn't the greatest thing to get to your news from.
Never let the facts get in the way of a good story.
Exactly. Cam. This came, actually, it was published on December 1st of 2016. This is something that some friends of mine had sent me, and I think it's hilarious. But it says, dying for a good night out, a Polish man wakes up in a morgue refrigerator after being declared dead when he drank too much vodka.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's not just the Irish that like to party, the Polish do. A 25-year-old Polish man who was declared dead after drinking too much vodka woke up and found himself in the morgue. And rather than go home to sleep it off after this terrifying ordeal, says here that the man went straight back out and rejoined his buddies at the pub.
Oh, yeah.
They said the fella's name was Camille, and he passed out after drinking a whole lot of vodka in this little country town, and he went into cardiac arrest and was pronounced dead. Paramedics arrived, arranged for him to be taken to this local morgue, and once he was there, tagged him, bagged him, and slid him in the refrigerator, right?
Yeah.
They say he started coming around later on that day, and the guard at the hospital was shocked when he heard noises coming from the freezer door. The guard opens the door and finds this dude standing there naked and shivering and says, man, can I get a blanket? Says the police were called, and after a medical checkup, he was free to go. Says having cheated death, the 25-year-old Kamal went straight back to the pub.
What a beast, man. Right? I'm a freaking lightweight. This guy drinks.
This guy
drinks so much till he has a heart attack.
A handle of vodka. Pours it on down, strokes out, wakes up in the morgue, like, I need a blanket and a breath mint. It's on and popping,
baby.
Where
are we going tonight, boys? Right?
Buckle up. You know what? That's the guy that if you don't finish all your beer, how are you going to be like, are you going to nurse on it all evening? I'm like, I died and came back and partied. You can't even finish one beer?
This is like a Bill Brasky story, man.
Bill Brasky. Exactly.
Also, I'd like to thank everybody. You know, last week we talked about doing that survey for us.
Yes.
For the Edison Research Company that's doing, you know, trying to develop some analytics for our show.
And wow.
And they said that we need to have at least 100 people do it. So we mentioned it on the show. And man, you guys knocked it out of the park. So thank you so much for everybody that took the time to do that survey for us. That's really going to help us. Don't forget, If you want to share a story of your own or a sighting, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 817-945-3828. You can follow us on all forms of social media. And sad news, Cam, did you see that Chuck Berry passed away?
I did see that. Yeah, I did see that.
Rock and roll legend, man. We just lost another one. 2017 has not been very good.
Yep, and Willie's sick. Willie Nelson's got the emphysema, and he's working also with pneumonia. His family released that, so it's not looking good. C'est la vie, said the old folks.
Man, not very good. Well, I hope everybody else has a really good week out there listening to this. For you elite members, we'll be speaking to you again on Thursday or Friday. Everybody else will talk to you again on Monday. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.